I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome back to Radio Times. At the end of the 19th century, while Oscar Wilde was being hailed as one of Britain's best and most successful playwrights and writers, he was arrested, put on trial, and found guilty of gross indecency because he was gay. He was sentenced to 2 years hard labor in prison. After his release, he lived in exile in France and died penniless and alone in Paris in 1900. He was just 46 years old. Opera Philadelphia's production of Oscar, that just opened at the Academy of Music, is about this difficult time in Wilde's life. It features our guest, acclaimed countertenor David Daniels, in the role of Oscar Wilde. He's making his Opera Philadelphia debut, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us is the composer of Oscar, Theodore Morrison, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty.
And rounding out our trio of guests is Wilde historian John Cooper. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, Marty.
If I could begin with you, and I'm sure you've been asked this before, David Daniels, why did you want to play this role?
I didn't want to play this role. I wanted an opera written for me by
Theo. You didn't care what opera?
I wanted a subject matter that was politically driven, was relevant today, and something that was personal to me in my own life. And when John Cox, the librettist, and Theo brought up Oscar Wilde, I just thought this could be not more. It was a perfect situation.
A trifecta there.
Perfect.
In part because, is there something operatic about Oscar Wilde himself?
I think his life was very operatic, yeah, right? Our story is really about the trial and the imprisonment. And I found even this morning on some social media that I was reading that of our opera, the disappointment that we didn't show all of the wit and all the happiness of him, but that was never our story.
Mm.
And so that I can't be apologetic about.
Well, to you, Theo Morrison, this is your first opera, yes?
Yes.
Tackling the sort of end couple of years of Oscar Wilde, why did you want to tell, I guess, this portion of his story?
Well, because everybody knows him as a playwright, as a poet, and the fun side of Oscar Wilde. And yet our opera includes his funny and witty side quite a bit, especially in the first act. But not many people in the general public have a real sense of what happened to Oscar Wilde in the last 5 years of his life, where he was tried, as we said, for gross indecency, which is the same crime that Alan Turing was tried for currently being shown in The Imitation mm. Game, the film. And that was in the late 50s. And, of course, Wilde was at the end of the 19th century. So the fact that that law stayed in effect all that time and wasn't rescinded until, I think, sometime in the 60s. It's a very interesting subject, and it is more operatic than the witty Wilde, it seems to me. It offers great dramatic possibility.
Well, let me turn to you, John Cooper, mm-hmm. as our Oscar Wilde historian. Then,
yes, sure.
Then set the stage for us, if you will, at this part of his life. And in, it almost feels as if he was entrapped, Oscar
yes,
Wilde.
Yes, well, to pick up where we've just been talking about the opera, I can support the approach taken by the opera to show the darker side of Wilde, because it's entirely legitimate to show Wilde's darker side, because to me, the wit and the humour and the bon mots and the comedy plays of the 90s are great for attracting anyone to Wilde, and that's usually the way that people find their way into Wilde, in many pathways to him. But what keeps you there, what kept me there, I think, was the tragedy of his afterlife, where he was imprisoned and never saw his family again. Never had a real lasting loving relationship, not even with his lover Bosie, Alfred Douglas. That was attempted but didn't last. And he did die in penury and in exile. So it's a very tragic story, particularly the treatment he received in prison, which comes out in the opera. Most of the second act is set in prison with Wilde at hard labour. And it was a regime that was cruel and unusual.
As I said, what I guess led to his trial and imprisonment was a kind of entrapment in that the father of his lover, Bosi, called him a sodomite.
Yeah.
He said that was a lie, which turned out to be a lie. And then he ends up in on trial.
It's quite a complex story, and there's motives of why Victorian society did make an example of Wilde. The law under which he was convicted was dated from 1885, a very unusual law that made gross indecency between consenting males in private became an offence for the first time. And not too many people had been convicted under it, but Wilde certainly was the most famous. And as Theo said, Alan Turing, it was in 1954 that his case came up, and he committed suicide that year.
Under the same law?
Yes, right. And that law was not repealed until 1967 fully, when Lord Arran, who took the bill through the British Parliament, quoted Wilde on the day it was repealed, saying that, quoting Wilde's remark, that the road to repeal would be long and red and with many monstrous martyrdoms, he said. And he quoted Wilde that day as a touchstone for that. He's very good, but...
Well, let me go back to you, David Daniels, which is how do you understand Oscar Wilde, the person you portray in this opera?
Well, I've said often that it was important for me to come to this role playing a real person, someone that everyone have seen photos of and have read his plays. And I didn't want to emulate him, to imitate the way he moved or looked. Or, I mean, obviously I'm in a costume and clean shaven.
Right.
But it was more to me about getting into the emotion of the piece, of the libretto, of this man, of what he went through, my own personal emotional connections to persecution and things like that that I bring to this piece. So it's really about me singing the human part of this was much more important to me.
Than reading a lot of books about Oscar Wilde or spending time on the internet.
To tell you the truth, I'm a singer that simply believes that I'm not sure had I read every possible book about Oscar Wilde that I would have brought any more heart or emotion to my performance than I do.
How about reading his letters or things like that?
Yeah, well, De Profundis I've read.
Right. It's his famous
Reading,
poem.
Reading Jail I've read. I read much more and learned much more after getting into the process of the opera, rehearsing. And I'm learning much more even sitting here.
Oh, you are? Oh, well, we like that. So do you see this as a tragedy, Theo?
Well,
is this a tragic opera?
It's the subject of it is tragic. But certainly it is a tragedy that anyone would be treated the way Oscar Wilde was treated just for being different than the majority of his or her society. So that in itself is tragic and something that we have to deal with in our own society right now on many levels and in different ways. And I feel that Oscar Wilde was a heroic character in some ways. He was, like all people, he had his flaws and had his difficulties with relationships of all kinds. But he was quite courageous about prison. He was changed by prison. And we, in fact, have one scene in the opera in which he goes to the infirmary after he had hurt his ear, and that is something that actually happened to him, falling in a chapel service. And he's sent to the infirmary, and he gets a chance to talk to the other infirmary patients in a much more human way than was possible in late Victorian prison, where the prisoners were kept from seeing each other by having to wear masks. And even in the chapel service, there were divisions between the seats so they wouldn't touch another prisoner.
Wow.
And so this was an opportunity for him to do that. So I think he grew as a human being as a result of it, but Oh, what a way to grow.
Well, indeed. And I'm even going back to the, you know, before he goes to prison, John Cooper, which is just, yeah. Here was Oscar Wilde, you know, this celebrity, if I can say, in Victorian England at
the
time.
Well, let me round out your earlier question about entrapment, because Wilde himself called Queensberry's approach to him the booby trap. And what happened was that Wilde was consorting with the Marquess of Queensberry's third son, Lord Alfred Douglas.
Consorting meaning? Well, they had a sexual relationship.
Well, yeah? They did. Yes. But Wilde sort of flaunted that more than most closeted homosexual people during that period, having lavish lunches at the Savoy and so on. But the backstory is that Queensberry's first son, Lord Drumlanrig, had died in a shooting accident, and he was rumoured to have had a homosexual liaison with the future Prime Minister, Lord Rosebery. He was his personal secretary. And Queensberry didn't want that happening again, another son going down the same path, and left this incriminating calling card at Wilde's Club in London, on which he'd scrawled, "To Oscar Wilde, posing as a sodomite," which he actually wrote somdomite in his...
Oh, somdomite.
Yeah, he misspelled it in his, perhaps in his rage or his ignorance. And it was Wilde who started the proceedings that led him to where he was. Wilde did say in a letter that he saw the life as an artist as a long and lovely suicide. And he'd already said when he started his career that somehow or other I'll be famous, and if not famous, I shall be notorious. So he
did he bring this on himself?
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, most people say, well, why on earth didn't he just tear up that card? His friends, like Frank Harris, who's in the opera, and Shaw, and Robert Ross, his literary executor later, all said, you know, forget it, Oscar. But Oscar had, this was it. He got a little histrionic about the card and went to his lawyers, along with Douglas, who hated his father, of course, and he pushed him into suing the Marquess of Queensberry for criminal libel. Mm. And when that case fell through, the Marquess, decided to give all the evidence he'd bribed, he'd cajoled out of the rent boys in London. He handed all that over to the police so that they could prosecute Wilde for these acts of gross indecency.
And we're almost having a break here. I mean, was that, do you think, pride on Oscar Wilde's part or just ego?
He had a destiny, I think. I think if he hadn't have done that, he would have done something else.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about Oscar Wilde, and we're also talking about a new opera called Oscar, based on the life of the writer Oscar Wilde, and it's here in Philadelphia, a production of Opera Philadelphia. And the voice you just heard is John Cooper. He's a creator of the website OscarWildeInAmerica.org, a member of the Oscar Wilde Society in London, and a founding member of the Oscar Wilde Society in America. Also with us is Theodore Morrison. He's composer, co-librettist of Oscar, founder of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society, also the director of the University of Michigan School of Choirs. I'm getting this totally wrong because I can't read my own writing. And I will pick up on that. But also with us is David Daniels, countertenor, who plays Oscar Wilde in this new opera. And we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with John Cooper, Theodore Morrison, and David Daniels about the life of Oscar Wilde and also this new opera, Oscar, which is here in Philadelphia, part of Opera Philadelphia. In fact, performances at the Academy of Music. I do want to play just a section from the opera. This is My Sweet Rose from the Santa Fe production, and we got the DVD, and it features you, David, countertenor, as Oscar Wilde, composed by you, Theo Morrison. I wonder if you could just set up this song and what is happening in the opera.
Sure. Oscar has just made the decision not to flee to Europe, has decided to stay and face the trial. Lots of different reasons why he decided to do that. I don't know if we know the definitive answer to that. But here, this is My Sweet Rose that I sing to Lord Alfred Douglas, Bosie, and my lover. And it's some of the most beautiful words I've ever read in my life, and some of the most beautiful music I've ever heard.
Wow.
Well, I think that's a perfect setup. But we're just going to play just a couple of minutes. And again, this is My Sweet Rose from the opera Oscar, featuring our guest countertenor David Daniels and our other guest composer Theo Morrison. Sweet Rose from the opera Oscar, featuring our guest countertenor David Daniels and composer Theo Morrison. You were saying, David, that those were some of the most beautiful words you've ever sung.
Yeah, I mean,
what is Oscar saying?
Well, I have to say, I'll say about the aria itself, it's my sweet rose, my delicate flower, my lily of lilies. And he's telling him that perhaps in prison is where I'm going to test the power of love. But I have to say, we didn't get to my favorite line.
Oh, I'm
and
sorry.
And that is, you are the atmosphere through which I see life. You are the incarnation of all lovely things.
That's quite lovely, isn't it?
I'd love the person if they said that to me, yeah.
And you're the composer, Theo.
Yeah, well, one thing I could say about this is that the opera is based on quotations, but primarily of Oscar Wilde, but also of three other characters in the opera, Ada Leverson, our soprano, who was played by Heidi Stober, and Frank Harris, who was Oscar's friend and a literary guy who was editor and owner of the Saturday Review in London, and at the age of – in his early 30s, he was an amazing fellow. And we have quoted things from his biography of Wilde. And, of course, Walt Whitman, who plays an important role in the opera.
And they had met, I guess, earlier in when Oscar Wilde came to the United States.
And came to New Jersey, right across the river. It was a very important meeting for both men, and they were drawn to each other, and they had a great discussion.
Well, and John Cooper, since you're the Oscar Wilde historian, and in this play, the trial is in a nursery, and the toys come to life. I think the judge is a jack-in-the-box or something. Yeah, so it's obviously making great light of obviously this terrible trial that ended in Oscar Wilde being sent to prison. What was it actually like when he was on trial? Was it kind of the trial of the century as we've had?
Yes, I suppose it was. And it got a lot of publicity. There were three trials in total. But there were lighter moments in it, some of which Wilde tried to introduce into his cross-examination, which...
So he was defending himself?
Yes. He was asked to explain some of his works, the homoeretic content of Picture of Dorian Gray, and even to explain a line that Alfred Douglas had written, which was "The love that dare not speak its name," which is the last line to a poem by Douglas called Two Loves. So Wilde, and when he explained that, he gave a very impassioned speech explaining what that was, just like the Michelangelo or Shakespeare, the love of an older for a younger man, a very Socratic dialogue that he had with these younger men to explain why, when he was cross-examined, he would dine with the groom and he would take to dinner the, you know, the servant boy. He would dine with them in London, and he saw no class distinctions, he said.
Did he admit he was gay on trial?
No. And, you know, for some time during Wilde's rehabilitation, there have been gay advocates who didn't really see Wilde as a gay martyr because of that, perhaps. But when you're facing 2 years in prison with hard labour, which is what he did, it's very difficult to admit that at that time in history. He did say later, like I said, about the many martyrdoms, he did think the cause would survive and that they would win in the end. But he really didn't express his sexuality too much. I think he was a very private man about that and didn't think it ought to have any positive discrimination. I think he thought it was natural to him to live the life he wanted and that society shouldn't put any restriction on that.
Back to you, David, and you're a countertenor. And I think for some people, that's a new kind of voice, especially coming from a man.
Well, it only comes from a man because there's no such thing as a female countertenor.
No, I understand that.
You know, it's not as new as everyone thinks.
Is that right?
No, unfortunately. there are lots of them now. The thing that's so wonderful is that, yeah, for people that aren't opera goers, it does startle you at first, I'm sure. But to me, it was always my most natural voice. Mm-hmm. It was always the way that I was meant to sing.
Did you try
as cliche
other
as
ways?
That sounds? Yeah, I did undergraduate and graduate with Theo. I was in his choirs as a tenor at Michigan.
But that didn't fit. Didn't fit your voice?
No, it just didn't work. And it wasn't until 1992 that I made the decision to be a countertenor,
which happened at Michigan, and I attended his first recital as a countertenor, which was near the end of his second year of his master's program, and I had not heard him do that, and I was blown away, and I wept my way through it. It was so beautiful, and I realized that he had found what he should do, and now he's the greatest countertenor in the world.
I mean, did you? This is sort of a weird question, but did you sort of have to come out as a countertenor?
No, but there were lots of articles that sort of insinuated that.
Well, that kind of offensive.
Well, both coming out as a countertenor and coming out as a gay man. It was both equated.
They came out together, in a sense.
Yeah, and that was not the case because I had come out as a gay man way before I became a countertenor. So it really wasn't that. I knew that what I had was unique. I did not foresee what has happened for me in my career, but I didn't care because I thought I had something unique, and I just went for it.
I'm so interested. I mean, as you said that you were singing as a tenor, was this voice just sort of hidden from you? Did you have to go find it or create it?
No. I sang like this from the moment I was a boy soprano. I did a lot of professional work. My voice changed. I never lost ability, nor did I stop singing that way. I would entertain at parties. I would sing in the car, shower, vacuuming at home, whatever.
This is your voice.
It was always my countertenor voice. I would never sing in my tenor voice.
It's not falsetto, though, right?
Well, I mean,
is it?
It is, but it's very that's too long a discussion.
Okay.
It's a very highly developed falsetto, and interestingly, I have been asked over the last couple of days from people in the audience who don't go to opera if the singers are mic'd, and when I say no, they're not mic'd, these people are shocked, and I was kind of shocked by their shocking, but opera singers are trained athletically to be able to get their voices past the footlights and to the person in the farthest seat in the house, and David's countertenor is enormous, mm-hmm. and an operatic countertenor, not like the lute song type person just sitting in a small room.
Although you have composed some other – you have composed for him as well.
Yeah, I wrote him a song cycle called Chamber Music using James Joyce's title of the set of poems that I extracted Chamber Music from.
What was the hardest thing about writing this opera for you? I mean, you'd never written an opera before.
No, I had to learn something about writing for the stage as opposed to writing for the concert hall, which has been my life, really. I didn't actually start writing until I was about 42.
Yeah.
But I was a conductor, and so I knew how to write music and knew how to hear the orchestra, knew what would work, what wouldn't, and voices, of course, the same thing. So the hardest thing about writing the opera was working out timing, working on the libretto with my colleague, which we did via email most of the time because he lives in London and I live in Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And so it was quite a challenge. But he is a great opera director himself, and he basically taught me what the needs of the stage were. So it took a long time, and we did a great deal of research about Weill as well. And so it was a 10-year project from idea, first idea, to getting it on stage in Philly, and 8.5 years to Santa Fe.
Oh, yeah. And I should say it had its debut in Santa Fe, having its East Coast debut in Philadelphia, at Opera Philadelphia. And are you still tweaking it?
We tweaked it right up until last night, actually. I mean, I saw David do something at the end of the opera last night that makes me want him to do it again.
Oh, really?
And again and again. And I told him about it in the car on the way over here.
Yeah?
And I don't want to give it away to your audience if any of them are going to come, and I hope all of them will come.
Of course. Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Theodore Morrison. He is the composer co-librettist of Oscar, a new opera that is, in fact, having its East Coast debut here in Philadelphia, a production of Opera Philadelphia, and it is about the last couple of years of Oscar Wilde's life. David Daniels with us as well. He's a countertenor. He plays Oscar Wilde in this new opera, and also with us is John Cooper, and he is an Oscar Wilde historian, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. If I can go back to you, John Cooper, Oscar Wilde gets sent to prison hard labor for 2 years.
Yes.
At the end of the 19th century, is hard labor, I mean, hard sort of backbreaking manual labor?
Absolutely. It took many forms. What we see in the opera, Wilde turning the crank, which was a Victorian machine, meant just for nothing but the useless turning. And it was difficult to turn, and it had a counter on it to make sure you did turn it the number of times that you were meant to.
Useless meaning it did nothing?
Did nothing.
You just turned it?
Yes, just like the treadmill was the same. A long Victorian heavy device that men would walk upon for no real purpose. Other things like picking oakum, which was the manual tearing apart of sea rope, of pine-tarred rope till the fingers bled almost. Well, Weill said that his did. And that had no purpose other than to create this string or this oakum, which was used in ships to patch up the boarding. But, it's utterly futile and meant only to break the man break him of his crimes, which, you know, never did.
Was he never? I mean, how do you think he was changed by prison, David?
I can't imagine being put through what he was put through. What makes me so sad, as John said, it's the crank in our opera. I think he was much more on the treadmill much more.
Well, it had a cathartic effect on Wilde. You mentioned earlier De Profundis, which is a letter, actually. It's over 50,000 words, one of the longest letters in literature. And in it, he talks about how he now has found sorrow.
Something new for him?
And, yes, regret. Yes, he'd lost his hubris. He could see how he had let his life as an artist be dragged down to the mire by Douglas and by the people around him. And he should have had higher ideals. And he blamed himself. Even though he blamed Bosie for certain incidents, like not supporting him when he was sick, and smaller items. In general, he was he blamed himself for where he was, and it was a cathartic process, and he was going to approach life with a new outlook after prison.
Go ahead.
And he wrote a poem about 10 years before he even met Bosie Douglas, in which he writes the end of our opera for us.
Really?
And he and the end of his own life, and he didn't even had no idea that this would actually happen. The poem is given a Greek title called Glukopikros Eros, and we translate it as bittersweet love. And he and we use it as the final big aria for David in the opera. But it's so prescient, and he wrote it so far in advance of these events that it makes it all the more poignant when it comes. To us, anyway.
Well, and it looks like you want to add something, David.
No, just I was going back to the Victorian prison and the photos that one sees. I mean, it's just horrible that you think this man and with this mind and what he gave the world, and then he died at 46. Can you imagine what would have been written had this not happened to him? Mm-hmm. And what will we have to read now? And that Bosie lived, what, till 76 years old?
Right, until 1945.
Till 1945.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And Bosie also became...
an average writer.
No, he's very litigious, and he... he was an average writer.
Well, Bosie was a decent poet.
Yeah, he was decent poet. He wrote in an
old
style.
But he was no
style.
Oscar Wilde, right?
Oh, no, poetry wasn't Wilde's strong point. He wrote in a lot of different mediums, children's stories, essays, lectures. But Wilde said about some of his earlier poetry that it had more rhyme than reason.
Oh.
But after prison, it did great. Produce Wilde's best poem, which is The Ballad of Reading Jail. Oh,
and that, I think, is a masterpiece, at least, of content.
Well, we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about both Oscar Wilde, the man, and a new opera called Oscar, having its East Coast debut here in Philadelphia. Our guests are John Cooper and Theodore Morrison and David Daniels. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. We are talking about the new opera Oscar, having its East Coast debut in Philadelphia, a production of Opera Philadelphia, and it is at the Academy of Music. Looks like it's on the 11th, the 13th, and the 15th of this month. And again, talking with David Daniels. He's countertenor. He plays Oscar Wilde in this new opera. In fact, having his debut with Opera Philadelphia. He has appeared in numerous operas since his debut 23 years ago. Theodore Morrison is composer, co-librettist of Oscar, and he is currently, I'm going to get this right, University of Michigan School of Music, director of university choirs, and director of the Graduate School of Conducting. I think I got that right.
Except that I'm emeritus. I am no longer
you're
there.
Oh, emeritus. Okay. Whoops. Well, we'll put that
in
there.
Another word for retired.
But Oscar Wilde and his opera have kept me from actually retiring.
Yes, I know about those kinds of retirements. Also with us, John Cooper. He is the creator of the website OscarWildeInAmerica.org and a member of the Oscar Wilde Society in London. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. In fact, we have a comment. I'll put this to you, John. A lot of people want to know about Oscar Wilde and Philadelphia.
Yes. Well, there's a It starts for me with a great conjunction, because one of the reasons Wilde came to America was to promote an opera. And so it's good that I'm involved in that pursuit myself. The opera was Patience by Gilbert and Sullivan.
Oh, Patience.
And the irony there was that was ridicule in the very thing that he was representing. But he had to have a start somehow. yes, in Philadelphia, people should go to the Rosenbach Museum and Library. There's a great exhibition there called Everything is Going On Brilliantly, which is a line from one of Wilde's letters from Philadelphia back home, because he was beginning to get successful. And if I could just mention one thing from that exhibition that's quite intriguing, and it's a credit to the curators Margaret Stetz and Mark Samuels Lasner, who are research fellows at the University of Delaware. They came across an archive of material at the Free Library, which had been hiding in plain sight. And one of the documents in there is a poetry notebook of Wilde's from the time. And there's another of Wilde's manuscript and typescript of Salome, his play that he wrote in French, one that's recently been adopted by Al Pacino in various forms. In the exhibition, you can see side by side Wilde's manuscript of Salome, and next to it, the typescript, which was based on the manuscript. In the manuscript, he has Elle Danse, she dances. And in the typescript, it says the same thing in typewriting, but in handwriting, and this has only just recently been found when we came across the archive in the Free Library, it's handwritten, she dances the seven veils.
Uh-huh.
Wilde has written that in French. And that's the first point at which we can see the creative process of Salome's famous... It became famous when Richard Strauss did an opera of Salome. And we see now the creative process. And it was a bit of a surprise to me. I wasn't quite sure about the Dance of the Seven Veils, but it did not predate Wilde. It's not biblical like Salome, and it doesn't appear in any other form. And so it's a Wilde creation there, and it's quite an interesting piece of scholarship that comes out of the exhibition.
Oh, that's fascinating. And in the opera, in fact, I guess the narrator, perhaps chorus, is Walt Whitman himself. And they did meet in Camden, as
yes,
I understand.
They did. And we needed someone to be a voice from the beyond somehow or other and be a narrator for certain aspects of the opera. And Whitman died just before Oscar and Bosie struck up their love affair. And as a result, it's perfect. It sets the stage very well. And so except for an appearance by Oscar himself prior to the prologue, which we call a curtain raiser, Whitman comes in and begins the prologue and sets the stage and tells us essentially what's going to happen, just as the chorus in Romeo and Juliet, for example, that gives us information about how that play will unfold.
We have an email from Marie. She says, I saw Oscar yesterday. My question is, Bosie has no vocals. Do they think he loved Oscar as much as Oscar loved him? Do you think Bosie's relationship with Oscar was in part despite his father? Okay, I guess I pointed to you, David.
You pointed to me,
and he's pointing to John.
I want to hear the answer, then I'll tell you, Mark.
Okay,
my
we'll
ideas.
Start with you, John. Go
Certainly,
ahead.
Bosie did love Oscar in as much as he loved him. Yeah, I think it's interesting though that in the opera, Bosie is just a dancer.
Right. He doesn't
because he wasn't present at the trial, and he wasn't in Wilde's life during his time in prison. And so it's a nice little move, an artistic move, to make him a dancer, to be buzzing around Wilde. Partly as irritant, partly as muse, and the dancer does a really good job. He looks just like the pictures we have of
Oh, interesting. Oh, interesting.
Yes, he's a beautiful dancer.
And from your perspective as the composer, made sense to have Bosie not sing?
Yeah, in fact, John Cox, my colleague, accused me of having the idea, and I think I did, actually. And and he loved the idea. And so, yeah, I mean... It also offers me as a composer an opportunity to go into another form of music right on the opera stage, and yet it has a deep relationship to the rest of the drama, and so to have dance sequences throughout the opera is very exciting. And Bosie is also wearing masks much of the time. And Oscar Wilde had said that if you give a man a mask, he'll tell you the truth.
Ah.
And that's a really wonderful statement. And so in almost every case, Bosie is first masked and then reveals that he is, in fact, Bosie by taking off his mask. But, of course, he's just a figment of Oscar's imagination throughout the opera.
Yeah. Just to pick up on what's going on in Philadelphia and the meeting with Whitman over in Camden, Oscar met Walt Whitman twice on both his visits to Philadelphia, made a point of seeing Walt Whitman. And this is the subject of a new play that's coming to the Walnut Street Theatre in March called Mickle Street, which takes the meetings as the scenario. So Michael Whistler is the author of that play, And I had him at I have a meetup group, a second Oscar Wilde book club that held in Philadelphia monthly.
Oh, wow.
And I invited Michael over and he introduced the play to us. So that was interesting.
So kind of an Oscar Wilde palooza happening there in Philadelphia.
Oscar mania.
you wanted to say something. You were listening to see what they said.
No, I want to believe that there was a love between the two of them. I think we have to play it that way in this opera. Oh. But as with any relationships, there's trouble. Mm. And he was younger, much younger, and was probably rather spoiled in his life and by Oscar. And this is something, obviously, that is very relevant today, too. We see this all the time.
Sure.
And in later life.
It's humanity, you know?
Yeah. And I agree with that. And in later life, Bosie became homophobic, at least publicly.
Yes.
And he married a woman named Olive, and who was a very boyish-looking woman. And they had a child named Raymond, mm-hmm. who I believe was schizophrenic.
He died in a mental institution.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Wow.
And Bosie Douglas was very litigious about the Ballad of Reading Jail, not the Ballad, the De Profundis letter,
right, sure.
And other things as well. And as you look at Lord Alfred Douglas growing older, it's something like the picture of Dorian Gray.
He gets, oh, that's so interesting.
He gets gnarled and something happens to his face and he looks like a very sad and angry man.
Not the pretty young boy that he
was. Nothing like that.
He was a changed man after Wilde's death. And he did a notorious vault face about Wilde's reputation under oath and called in the most pernicious influence there had been for 350 years and said Salome was a terrible piece of work. But Douglas was litigious all his life. He was always getting himself into trouble with law cases, and I don't think he really knew who he was either.
I'm curious about how you prepare. You're going to be performing three performances of this opera this week. How do you prepare? For a performance.
As in actually my sort of...
Like an actually, yes. Okay. Like your voice, your other...
Well, this is a tough sing. It's a rewarding opera to sing, but it's a very difficult one to sing because I don't stop singing. Mr. Composer?
Yes, but you told me that was okay.
Yeah. He wrote this apparently with you in mind. So,
you know, they're very close together, the performances. In Santa Fe, it's a repertoire company, so there are five operas going on at the same time. So there's sometimes up to 9 days between performances in Santa Fe.
Oh.
So I have no history with this piece in this sort of close proximity or the closeness of performances together, what's trying to say. So it's going to be a lot of quiet.
Is that what you do?
Silent. Totally silent the day off. I will just drink probably 6 liters of water and steam and hope for the best.
Is that typically what you do?
I mean, if I have 2-3 days, then I have a normal life.
Right.
But with this, I got to be really careful.
It would be something like a baseball pitcher. It would be nice if he had 4 days off between games, but he doesn't in this case.
It's a great analogy. I've used that before.
And now we all know it. Here's a tweet from Kristen. Having known the story before seeing the opera Oscar, Daniels absolutely hits the emotional center of the man. That's
well,
to
thank
you.
I appreciate that.
Was it hard to get to the emotional center of this man?
It was hard to get to the emotional place where I have ended, where I'm in control of my emotions. Because when we first did this in Santa Fe, it took me by surprise how emotional it was, because I am a gay man, and in this, playing a gay man in love with a gay man was very powerful, but I had no idea how powerful it was going to be until we got into staging it.
Wow.
And we were shedding a lot of tears in Santa Fe. So it's better here because I've sort of controlled that a little bit.
You don't want to cry on stage?
Well, teared-eyed is one thing, but, you know, you got to... I think you're stronger if you keep yourself together.
This is for you as well, an email from HT. Saw the Friday night opening, was mesmerized by the story and David's voice. This is an extraordinary opera experience. Glad you talked about the dancer, too. He was incredible. Beautiful movements. Bravo. Well, and I know you've been working on this opera. Kind of, there were some pros and cons, I guess, after its Santa Fe debut?
Sure. I mean, we had bad reviews. We had good reviews. We had people telling us what they liked, what they didn't like. And I've learned from all of that. And I realized last night in particular, I felt that everything came together in a way that I grew to understand my own opera last night more than I had previously. So all of the criticism, negative and the positive and wonderful positive comments from people helped me, I think, to grow and realize that some changes should be made in the opera. And so John and I worked on this, John Cox in London and I worked on this together with Kevin Newberry, our director, who is doing a fantastic job, and with David. It's been a kind of quartet of people talking about what would work to make it even stronger. And so having a double commission like this is very, very helpful.
Well, we are talking about the opera Oscar having its East Coast debut here in Philadelphia, talking with the composer Theodore Morrison, David Daniels, who plays the title role, Oscar Wilde, and Oscar Wilde historian John Cooper. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. So after Oscar Wilde is released from prison, is he in exile in France? Is that how he dies in Paris?
Well, it's a long story about the rehabilitation of Oscar Wilde after prison. The opprobrium started immediately and he was treated as a social pariah. And even after his death, critics regarded him as a minor literary figure to be grouped along with the other decadents of the 1890s. And it took a long time, probably up until the 1950s, before he was accepted back.
Wow.
Possibly in conjunction with a move towards tolerance towards homosexuality. And by that time, everyone who knew Wilde had died and their attitudes had died with them. And it's a long story.
Indeed. And we're almost out of time here, David Daniels, but I just wanted to make sure our listeners knew that you were married by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg about, what, a year or so ago?
No, it was only June 21st.
Oh, okay. Of 2014.
Of 14.
Do you know her?
I've met her many times after performances. She was very supportive and vocal about Oscar. Our performance, ironically, happened in Santa Fe just a month after the whole Supreme Court decision came down about gay marriage. And she came to the opera. The Washington Post magazine was doing a big article on her, so they took a photo of us together in my Oscar Wilde costume. And I just thought, if you don't ask, you won't get an answer. So I did an email through her secretary, and a day later I got a personal email back and said, if you and Scott, my husband, can come to Washington, D.C., it would be an honor to do it. And we put it together in 6 weeks, and we did it. It was very nerve-wracking.
Where did you do it?
The Dumbarton House in Georgetown. Beautiful setting. She's a wonderful woman.
Well, it's been wonderful to have all three of you on Radio Times. My thanks to all of you for coming in and talking about Oscar and Oscar Wilde. So thanks so
Thank
much.
You.
Thank
it's
you.
It's a pleasure.
You're welcome. And again, our guests have been countertenor David Daniels, composer Theodore Morrison, and Oscar Wilde historian John Cooper, talking about this new opera having its East Coast debut in Philadelphia, a production of Opera Philadelphia, and it's at the Academy of Music on February 11th, 13th, and 15th. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the program, how to find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and check out the archives as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.